Good morning and welcome to the Atlanta Business Radio Show. I'm Amy Otto, joined by Lee Cantor. Good morning, Lee.
Good morning, Miss Amy. How are you doing this fine morning?
I'm great. You know, I woke up and I heard the pitter-patter of rain, and guess what I did?
You had to go to the bathroom.
No, I ran outside at 5:45 and sprinkled some grass seed. I was so excited.
Oh, that's right. You can't. I don't know anything about gardening. This is now you plant grass now?
Yeah, big deal when it rains, and it hasn't rained in a long time.
So first thing in the morning, you were out there with your little machine?
No machine, just high heels, you know, to aerate, and then I sprinkled my seed.
That's impressive.
It's growing as we speak. Love the rain. We've got three great guests this morning, and, you know, the rain, sun, no matter what, there's one thing I love to put on my feet.
What is that?
Flip-flops.
Flip-flops.
Flip-flops. I love to let my toes breathe. Excited about our guest this morning, Darren Kreisch, who is the CEO of the Flip-Flop Shops. Welcome to the Atlanta Business Radio Show.
Good morning, Amy.
So, Darren, I love your shirt, Work, Play With Your Toes Exposed. Tell us about your company.
That's it. We are starting the worldwide movement to free your toes. We are a new franchise opportunity that just started in January, and currently we have 13 franchises sold. We've got 5 stores open out on the West Coast. Things seem to be going great. Even in this ridiculous economy, we're seeing lots of activity. You know, people really looking to take their lives on their own shoulders, you know, and take responsibility for themselves. A lot of people out there with that entrepreneurial spark that really want to go out and work for themselves, and we're seeing a lot of interest.
It sounds like you've had background in franchising and other concepts before. How did you come up with the concept of the flip-flop shops?
Well, you're right. For the last 15 years, at some level or other, I've been involved in franchising. Myself, the president of Flip-Flop Shops, Brian Curran, and our chief operating officer, Alan Woods, we all three have worked together. We're the original team that helped to start and franchise Cold Stone Creamery years ago. And most recently, we're all principals in Raving Brands here in Atlanta. Most of you all know that as Moe's Southwest Grill. And once we sold Moe's, we all decided that we really wanted to do something different. We'd been in the food business for a long time. We ran across Todd and Sarah, who were the founders of the Flip-Flop Shops idea. You know, it's really a great story, too. Sarah was walking down the street in Las Vegas. They were out there on a trade show. Sarah works for Todd. And they had spent all day on the convention floor and were walking back to the hotel. And Sarah said, "Oh, my feet are killing me. You know, I got to find some flip-flops." So she went on the great flip-flop hunt in Las Vegas. And guess what? Couldn't find any because it was the wrong time of the year. So she decided, you know, I think we should open up a flip-flop shop. And Todd, being a textbook entrepreneur, said in his great Boston accent, "Yeah, Sarah, I think that's a great idea. Let's open some flip-flop shops." And, you know, that's how the whole idea germinated. And he, you know, they opened up a temporary store just to test the idea up in Boston, you know, in the middle of the winter.
The flip-flop capital of America.
Yes, absolutely. The flip-flop capital of America. And he found that it did great, even in the winter in Massachusetts. And so he thought, well, gosh, let's, you know, see what this thing can do out on the West Coast. And they proceeded to open stores out in California. California and Arizona, and that's really when we ran across them and said, "Wow, this is a great idea. Let's see if these guys are interested in, you know, taking this thing to the next level and using some of our resources and, you know, our experience and really our vision to create a niche that we found completely missing in the market today, and that is a retail store that it has one core focus." And that's flip-flops. 365 days a year, all we focus on are flip-flops. You know, I would really kind of equate flip-flop shops really to the Sunglass Hut model. You know, we have the hottest brands, latest styles, all in one roof, 365 days a year. And so if you're really a flip-flop aficionado, it's a great place to come and find your footwear.
What kind of person's being attracted to being a franchise owner?
That's a great question. I mean, we really don't put a bunch of financial restrictions and rules and regulations on, you know, potential franchisees. We are all entrepreneurs, and we wanted to create a concept that welcomed people that had that entrepreneurial spark, just regular, everyday, hardworking people that, you know, had a passion for flip-flops, that wanted to take responsibility for their, you know, for their lives and wanted to work for themselves and had a little bit of business acumen behind them, mm-hmm. you know, and give everybody an opportunity, whether they got a small business loan, whether they borrowed money from a relative, you know, took, you know, back in the day when you could actually use your home equity line to help fund a business. But there's several ways that people are getting financed for these things. We're giving tons of people the opportunity. But really, I think the key quality is a passion for flip-flops. And you'd be amazed how many people actually get passionate about flip-flops.
Is this a concept that women are the owners of typically, or is it men right now?
Actually, if you look at our franchise makeup right now, it's about 50-50, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. Now, I would say that the consumer probably skews a little bit female. Mm-hmm. But as far as business ownership, we're seeing it across the board, you know, from, you know, people that are older that have, you know, worked for IBM for 20 years, mm-hmm. you know, to people that are just graduating from college. You know, one of the franchisees that I'm most excited about is a young man named Scott Santee. 27 years old, born and raised in Wisconsin, called us to talk to us about flip-flop shops. You know, again, Wisconsin, another
right.
another hotbed.
Right.
Makes my toes cold to think about that.
And called us up, and we were talking to him about franchising in Wisconsin. And then he went on a little vacation to Las Vegas. And he called us from the hotel, and he said, "Oh, my gosh, I want to open a flip-flop shops in Las Vegas." And so we went to work for Scott Santee and signed him up as a franchisee, and I'm excited to announce that we will actually be opening his store in January, February of 2009 in Mandalay Bay out on the Vegas Strip. So we're very excited about the location. The folks at MGM are great. They've been great to work with. They're excited about flip-flop shops, and it's going to be fun to see that young man from Wisconsin take on his new life as a big business owner out on the Vegas Strip.
I guess. You know, I think about college towns being big flip-flop towns. Are you finding that there are any locations in college towns?
You know, I'm a big fan of college towns. You know, from the days at Cold Stone Creamery, obviously, mm-hmm. we were always a big hit in the college towns. You know, in fact, up in Gainesville, Florida, home of the Gators, that's one of the top Cold Stone Creameries to this day in that market. Moe's Southwest Grill, same thing. In fact, in Gainesville, one of the top three stores in the entire country. So, yeah, we feel the same way. We think flip-flops are going to be great, you know, mm-hmm. in college markets. We've yet to find the right franchise partner for a college town, but I'm sure it's coming soon.
Maybe one of our listeners.
That's right.
You never know. I would think that would be a great market. And then also, you know, as you say, people for a passion with flip-flops, I can think of at least five off of the top of my head. How about you, Lee?
What?
People with passion for flip-flops. Yeah. Like every time you see them, they're wearing flip-flops.
Right.
It's you know, 40
and
degrees
no one has,
and they're wearing
no
flip-flops.
No woman has just one pair.
Oh, no.
Right?
No.
What,
no.
Do you have any stats on that?
Well, you know, actually, it's interesting.
I bet you do.
Women do own multiple pairs. Problem is it's not three or four pairs. It's more like 12
really?
Is the national average. In fact, an incredible statistic that I'll be perfectly honest, when I first heard it, I looked at Brian and I said, "Brian, you just made that up. There's no way that's true." Sure enough, in 2006, flip-flops outsold athletic shoes $20 billion to $17 billion worldwide. And I think that really just shows you that there's an incredible market out there for the product. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing is that flip-flops have really evolved from the utilitarian, mm-hmm. you know, shower shoes
right,
that they
right.
used to be. Into more of an everyday comfort footwear. I mean, everybody feels a little bit more relaxed. It's just a little bit more easygoing when you're being, you know, when you're able to free your toes. And we're seeing people do this, you know, at church,
right?
At work when they can sneak them by the boss. Mm-hmm. We're seeing them going on dates, out to dinner, to the movies. You know, they've really, you know, and the quality, too, has really changed. You know, there's a great new brand out there called Olakai, which means comfortable ocean in Hawaiian. And these flip-flops are the first pair of flip-flops. They were invented by a guy that used to work at Nike. They've got tennis shoe rubber on the bottom of the flop. They've got a heel cup, the nice arch support made with top grain leather. I mean, it's like wearing, you know, an awesome pair of sneakers. Difference is You get the freedom of your toes with the comfort of the sneakers.
I like my toes. Lee, some people don't feel great about their toes. How do you feel about your toes?
I'm a sneaker guy.
You're a sneaker
guy? No flip-flops for me.
Oh, he might be able to change your mind.
Could somebody mute his mic?
It is a female thing, though. I mean, I love flip-flops, and I think it is more of a casual feel as well. And with more companies sometimes going casual Fridays or just the environment being more casual, are you seeing that that's more of the case in people coming to buy dress-up flip-flops?
Yeah, that's one of our local marketing ideas for franchisees is to, you know, go to the local schools, go to the local office buildings, you know, your insurance agent's office, and sponsor flip-flop Fridays. So, yeah, along that theme of casual days, you know. And what we're seeing, in fact, I told our attorney's office in Dallas, Texas, a great big law firm out there, big, you know, fancy pants law firm, we told them, if you don't sponsor flip-flop Friday, we're moving our business. So guess what? Next March, we're going to have flip-flop Friday at the attorney's office.
That's great. Nice. That is great. Any additional information you want our listeners to know, where can they find you? What's your website?
Our website is www.flipflopshops, and that's S-H-O-P-S, plural, flipflopshops.com. And we welcome people to, you know, visit us. There's telephone numbers on there. You can contact me directly. You can contact us via email. But we'd love to talk to anybody who's interested in starting their own business. And, you know, like I said, changing the way the world works and actually going out and helping to create more small businesses. You know, you hear it day after day by the politicians. Small business is the engine of our economy, and we're really proud to be a part of that in helping to create jobs, additional tax base, and really giving people a chance to go out and work for themselves.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for being our guest today. Before you leave, I've got to see what flip-flops you have on.
Oh, well, I've got my brand new Astro Deck flip-flops, and I'm actually glad you asked about them. They're a brand new flip-flop that a man in California named Herbie Fletcher has come out with. Now, Herbie Fletcher, for those of you that don't know, is a legendary California surfer. I mean, he is really your stereotypical surf bum, a guy that's been surfing his entire life. About 25 years ago, created Astro-decked traction pads for the back of the surfboards. So if you've ever seen a surfboard that has that traction on the back of it, Herbie Fletcher's the one that invented that. And one of the surfers that really benefited from that was his son, Christian Fletcher, who is one of the top surfers in the world, as is his son, Nathan. And they have taken that traction from the surfboards and put it on to the shoes. And his tagline is, it makes you feel like you're surfing all day. And I'll tell you what, they are incredibly comfortable, and they're called Astro Deck.
They look comfortable, although all those little bumps, do they just massage your feet all day long?
That's what it feels like.
I mean,
it's almost like you're getting a foot massage all day long.
Those are serious flip-flops.
I mean, I'll tell you right now, I've got my choice of flip-flops in my closet, as you can imagine, and the Astro Deck flip-flops are always one of my favorite pairs.
Wow. That's great.
And on the website, can they see the different brands you sell?
Yep, we actually have links to all the different brands. And here in the near future, we will be expanding into an e-based business as well.
Wow.
Awesome. Thanks so much for being our guest today. Lots of fun. I can't wait to check out your website.
And thanks, Amy. We had a great time.
Flip-flop shops.
Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Next up, we have something a little bit more serious, although I'm sure he has a sense of humor, too. Tim Darnell is a veteran Atlanta-based journalist with more than 20 years of online newspaper and magazine experience. He currently serves as the editor of Business to Business Magazine, B2BMagazine.com, a publication which he was also the founding editor of 11 years ago. Welcome to the Atlanta Business Radio Show, Tim Darnell.
Well, Amy, thanks for having me. It's kind of an interesting dichotomy going from flip-flops to the crashing global financial markets that's happening this morning. But when you were gracious enough to attend a business-to-business event not too long ago, a couple weeks ago, we met and you were kind enough to extend the invitation to me, so it's a pleasure. I've been listening to you guys a lot, and here I am in your high-tech studios with the sound muting carpet on the walls and on the desk, so it's a thrill to be here today.
very high tech here at the Atlanta Business Radio Show. I'm really happy that you agreed to come and be our guest, because at the Atlanta Business Radio Show, we really do strive to put a spotlight on Atlanta businesses and focus on the positive in the Atlanta business community. And oftentimes I find that in business to business. I love your regular updates. It seems like when it comes to business in Atlanta, you are on the cutting edge. So I'd love to know, how do you come about acquiring your information? Do people come to you? Do you go out to them?
Well, you know, honestly, Amy, the magazine's been around for about 11 years. It's only been within the past year or so that we really redesigned, relaunched, reformatted the website. My line of work now is entirely different. My typical day is entirely different than it was a year ago, simply because we're dealing in so much real-time information. When you come into work one morning and you see the Dow Jones Industrial Average drop 777 points, and you're dealing in real-time information, there's not really a whole lot that you can do on a print magazine, because we're a bi-monthly now. So really, it's a matter of just extending your reach into as many different industries, as many different professions as you can. We have a number of good friends who work at some of Atlanta's top law firms, Atlanta's top financial advisory firms, always coming to us and saying, hey, can we do something on the website about how a particular investor really needs to weather the current financial crisis? What do you need to do as far as your portfolio goes? Mm-hmm. What does it mean for if this particular candidate is elected to the White House? In this particular day and age that we're living in right now, there's not a better time, really, to be a journalist. If you love covering business, if you love covering politics, there's no shortage of information. And really, we just try to provide the analysis that helps our listeners and our readers really become better business people, and also really to survive the current financial crisis that we're in.
So there's a lot of different elements to the online portion of business to business. Can you talk a little bit about some of them?
Sure.
Like the blog, the podcast?
The blog, we have a fully interactive website, www.b2bmagazine.com. Shameless plug there, advertisement. We find that our podcasting portion, similar to what you and I are doing today with Lee, is really one of our fastest growing components of our website. All of our podcasts are available on iTunes. We do a weekly Friday B2B report where we look at the various headlines over the past week, as well as special guests and analysis. We have podcasts on financial management, technology, marketing, executive coaching. Also, we have links to virtually every major national and international news website via RSS feeds, what's called really smart or really simple feeds.
How are your readers embracing the new technology?
As I said, the podcasting portion really is the fastest growing segment of our website. These are things that you can download when you're on the treadmill, if you're working at your office one afternoon, similar to what you guys do here at Atlanta Business Radio. There is a learning curve among executives who are maybe 50 and over.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone younger than that, and our audience is companies with revenues of $10 million and higher, really embraces the new technology, as is shown by our analytics.
It's a great way to multitask, because with the podcast, unlike being able to read a publication, you can listen, you know, passively while, like you said, on the treadmill or in your car. We all know in Atlanta we have a lot of long commutes, so it's a great way to listen to what's going on in the Atlanta business community. One thing I really do like is the way your magazine then ties into specific events, sometimes educational, sometimes social. Can you talk a little bit about how you come up with those types of events and topics?
Well, it's interesting. Just next week we're having an education town hall event with former Governor Roy Barnes, current Lieutenant Governor Casey Cagle, some other folks down at the Georgia Pacific Auditorium. And really what we try to do is tie our events with things that we know are important to Atlanta's business community. It's been over the past year that you've really seen a lot of Atlanta's top corporate leaders get behind the notion that our high school graduation rate is in the bottom third of the nation. It's a national disgrace. when business gets involved, and this has been shown time and again, when business or industry gets involved in a public policy issue and begins driving that issue, then and only then things really begin to change. We know that education, Georgia's educational system, is a top imperative priority to companies like Bell South, Georgia Pacific, what have you. So we try to design events around things that we know are of a topical and vital interest to our audience.
It's hard to have future leaders in the Atlanta area if the educational system is messed up, right?
Exactly. And, you know, there's always been the very dark, cynical joke that we can go around saying, thank God for Mississippi or Alabama. Otherwise, we would be dead last.
Right.
And it's really what's happening with our educational system is just a total disgrace. But I won't get too high on my high horse and go off on a tangent.
Now, your decision to take the magazine from a monthly publication to bi-monthly, is that something that has to do with the environment? I mean, a lot of people are going that route just to save paper. And going more green, is it?
I would probably be fired if I said what I really think
about the
decision to go bi-monthly. It's not something that I particularly agree with the economy being what it is. I understand it.
Mm-hmm.
I would like for us to take our product 100% online, digital. It would make me very happy
mm-hmm.
if I never saw a physical version, printed version of B2B Magazine in our hands anymore, because that really is the way where a lot of people are getting their news. And that's something that we are looking at. I would prefer us to stay bi-monthly, but hey, we have to do what you have to do in the current economy.
I'm still not there yet. I still like the actual publication and holding on to it in my hand. I mean, even if it is every month, I still like my magazines. I mean, I might be one of the few, but there's something a little bit more relaxing about the reading when you can curl up on your sofa as opposed to when you're at your laptop.
I think that there are certain genres, such as the magazine that I see on your desk, Atlanta Social Season Magazine, mm-hmm. Gloria Lane, who you had on last week. Sports Illustrated, maybe to a certain degree, but I believe your feature-oriented magazines, your People, your GQ, your Cosmo, whatever, lifestyle publications, there will always be a place for that.
Mm-hmm.
In the real-time breaking news environment that we're operating in right now, I'm not so sure.
That's a good point, because when it does come to business, it changes much quicker. In the
glossy much more so pictures. Over the past couple of weeks than ever before since the 1930s.
Absolutely. Now, who's one of the most interesting people you've ever interviewed, whether it's for a print story or for a podcast in the Atlanta business community?
I would have to say former President Jimmy Carter,
mm-hmm.
who was on our fourth cover when we started B2B Magazine 11 years ago. Fascinating individual. Got to go out to Evander Holyfield's mansion. That was back when he was still in his prime. Had only met him a couple of weeks after Mike Tyson took a piece out of his ear.
Ooh.
So we were trying very hard not to stare at the left ear and the little chunk out of it. But, I mean, being a journalist for 23 years, it's been, and I hope I have at least 20 more years ahead of me, and a whole lot of other interesting people to meet. But there's no other profession I can think of where you can meet so many fascinating and accomplished people throughout all realms of society.
How do you feel about the economy? What's your prognosis?
I find it very interesting that as we're speaking right now, the global financial markets are continuing to crash. I found it very interesting that the $700 billion bailout bill that was passed late last week was supposed to stabilize the floor of not only the domestic financial market, but the international as well. Complete opposite effect. You know you're in a crisis when the President of the United States has to say, hey, everybody slow down. Wait a minute. We have to have time for this package to take effect. I would have been perfectly content to let the markets correct themselves. I'm very uncomfortable with the notion of the federal government being a mortgage landholder. However, you know, time is really going to tell, and you know, with the presidential election being less than 30 days away, who would have ever thought that we would be looking at the current economic climate that we're looking at
What
right
about
now?
The people that you interview? Are you getting a sense of pessimism or optimism?
A great deal of unease, a great deal of skepticism. No one really out there is optimistic right now. We see a lot of layoffs when you see eBay laying off thousands, when you see the state of Georgia being in a possibly a $2 billion deficit and a possible special session to look at the economy and the state budget. I do not see any optimism whatsoever out there at all.
Wow. That sounds dismal.
No, it's a buying opportunity. People make money in all markets.
Sure. And we had actually one of our columnists only a couple of months ago, Richard Warner, probably Georgia's best-known business journalist, saying, now is the time to start a business because when the economy turns around,
you'll be
on the cutting edge.
Right.
And I firmly believe that Atlanta will turn around faster
than the rest of the country.
Than the rest of the country, simply because of the strength of our local economy.
And you feel the strength of our local economy. That was my question. How is it for people coming to Atlanta? Do you feel we are recruiting folks still into the Atlanta area for business?
No question about it. Sam Williams and our good friends down at the Metro Chamber of Commerce making a point of saying that Atlanta is the number one attraction for the quote-unquote young and the restless.
Okay.
Age 25 to 35, young, upwardly mobile, urban-oriented. Atlanta by far has one of the highest standards of living for that demographic. And affordable lifestyle. The only negatives we hear, obviously, is the one that we all face every single solitary day.
Traffic,
no question whatsoever.
But if you move in town, it's less of an issue.
Exactly. My wife and I just got through adding a second story to our little in-town home.
Right. You know, so.
It is. Atlanta is such a great place to live, and watching the business community grow just in the 14 years I've been here has been very exciting. Tim, thanks so much for being with us
today.
Always
a pleasure. Thanks so much.
How can people find out about business to business now if they haven't heard it from me already? Because I'm a big advocate of people becoming subscribers of your newsletter and your daily blogs.
You can go to www.bsinboy.com, b2bmagazine.com, updated every day with 4 to 5 new pieces of daily content, and sign up for our twice weekly newsletter every Monday and every Friday via our website.
And if you want the magazine, that's newsstands everywhere?
Newsstands everywhere, Borders, Barnes & Nobles, call our office, and we will be happy to put you on our mailing list.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Appreciate it.
Next up, we have Todd Schnick, who is the founder of Intrepid. Intrepid seems a little obscure to me, so I'm going to have some definition. All right. Welcome to the Atlanta Business Radio Show, Todd.
Thanks, Amy. It's great to be here.
Tell us, Intrepid, what is it? Is it a car?
What's it mean?
Is it a company? Tell us what it means.
Well, when I started this little business, I didn't want to just do the Schnick and Associates, which a lot of people do. And so I wanted to do something that was a little bit different,
Because people would have said, what's your Schnick?
But I wanted something strong, something bold, masculine, and frankly, something very marketable. And I was determined to use something from a passion of mine. And I brainstormed, and I could not come up with anything good from the Beatles or the Boston Red Sox. And so I went to a passion of mine since I was a child, which was America's Space Program. And so I literally went through a list of the name of virtually every spacecraft that ever was named by NASA, and Intrepid was the lunar lander on Apollo 12.
Hmm.
Now, we all know about the Eagle, which was the lander in Apollo 11. But Intrepid was the name of the spacecraft that landed on the moon in Apollo 12. And it means resolutely courageous, fearless, and bold. And I thought that was a strong way to define my company and what I do and what I hope to do and help my clients be intrepid in their marketing.
Can you talk about what you guys do?
Yeah, we're a small business marketing shop, and then we also do some political consulting work. So obviously, that's keeping me very busy this particular day and age. But when I started the company, I wanted to create a marketing resource for small business, and I'm not talking about large businesses. I'm talking about the small business, the entrepreneur.
Define small business, though. I mean, is it a revenue? Is it how do you define?
Most
small
of
business?
My clients have 10 or fewer employees.
Mm-hmm.
Probably maybe 2 million, 2.5 million in revenue and less. I really wanted because I was an entrepreneur myself, and when I was trying to find marketing assistance, whether it was strategic planning or whether it was actual tactical delivery on direct mail or website development, I didn't find a lot of affordable resources for a very, very small business. And I wanted to provide a place where a small business person could come and get quality material. A decent-looking website that wasn't an amateur website. I mean, it wasn't a website for dummies kind of a mm-hmm. thing that I would do if I was left to my own devices. I wanted a place where a small business person can go and get quality advice and get quality tactical deliverables for a price that they could afford as a startup small business person.
So walk us through what you might do for a specific client. You don't have to give the name, but what is the scope of what you would provide a company?
Well, let me preface that answer by saying when I started Intrepid, my majority of my business actually is in direct response marketing, direct mail.
Mm-hmm.
And that stems from my 16-year political career doing all the direct mail that everybody's getting in their mailbox as we speak. It's my fault, and I apologize in advance for that. But when I started Intrepid, I was really intending it to be a direct mail shop, a direct response marketing resource for small business. And so I would identify a prospect, and we would sit down, and we'd talk about their campaign. I'd say, all right, well, how does this fit into your overall marketing strategy?
Mm-hmm.
There'd be a long pause, and I don't really have
a
long-term business strategy. And I'd say, okay, well, I understand that. What's the messaging? What's the story you're trying to tell to your prospects to spark an interest in finding out whether your product or service is something that they need? Didn't have a good story to mm-hmm. tell. And if you've been to a networking situation, you've seen firsthand the poor stories that people tell about their personal business, which is very frustrating for someone like me. Or I'd ask the question, all right, well, you seem to see value in direct mail and there's potential value to your business there. Who are we targeting this to? Who is the audience that this needs to go to? And they either didn't know who their target audience was, or if they did, they didn't really know how to find them and how to actually get a list that they can mail to. And so my business evolved into just delivering on direct mail production, helping a lot of these clients answer some of those questions. And so to answer your question, most of my clients are very, very small businesses, and they're one-man shops. They do the production, they do the sales, they do the management, they do the books, they do everything. And I have found that most people in that situation, the thing that falls off the to-do list is their marketing.
Mm-hmm.
And marketing is the art and science of getting and keeping profitable customers. And if you don't do that, then you're not going to get customers profitable or otherwise. So we sit down and I force them to think through what their marketing plan is. And it's you can hire a high-end consultant to produce a phenomenally quality marketing plan, but it doesn't require a lot of rocket science.
Mm-hmm.
They're basic principles in putting together a marketing plan. And I found that most business people haven't done it because they don't think they know how to do it. They don't realize that it's actually a relatively simple process, but it's vital to the success of their enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you're kind of pitching direct marketing, that some people have a negative connotation with that. They think it's the 1-800 commercials and you're going to be harassing. It's going to be too salesy. And a lot of small business people are more brand-oriented rather than, ROI-oriented. How do you get past that?
Well, it also depends on who I'm talking to. The majority of people I'm talking to have a product or service to sell where direct mail or some sort of direct response marketing makes more sense. Now, for instance, let's use Aflac as an example. People don't listen to those TV commercials about the duck and say, oh, I have to go buy insurance right away. Right. What that's doing, that is establishing a brand and an awareness and a respectability in the marketplace that's a quality product. And so that and when they come across an agent in the field, then that person has instant credibility by virtue of those commercials. That make them that increase their ability to sell that product. What my clients are looking for is they're trying to sell roofs. They're trying to sell consulting services. They're trying to lawn care service. They're trying to get websites designed. They're trying to do just products that they're trying to sell. And so, my favorite example is I had a landscape company that was trying to grow their business. And he said, I tried to do some direct mail. It's just I got some business out of it, but it was almost cost prohibitive. And I can see the value because it did generate some results, but it just didn't seem to be in the ROI. I mean, I just wasn't – it was just cost me too much money. And so we just sat down over a cup of coffee and had a very basic conversation about it. And I asked what I thought was going to be a very simple question. I said, all right, well, how did you find your mailing list? And he answered that question. And I said, all right, well, first of all, you removed all the apartments from your list, correct? And he paused for a minute and realized, you know, I'm a landscaping guy, and I'm – third of my list was apartment dwellings.
Oh, no.
Well, those are the kind of things that right. You know, the average person's not thinking about, yeah. You know, and just cutting the cost of that project by a third by not sending the postage, not printing a third of those pieces, suddenly he realized, all right, well, this thing can be affordable.
So
and
maybe
sense.
The results were better.
It was absolutely better because right. it cost him less to execute the program. And he, you know, he narrowed his niche a little bit to better and got better response. So it's little things like that that so many people don't think through, whether they don't know about, whether they don't think about those things or they just don't know to ask those questions.
Mm-hmm. Sure. It sounds like your background has really gotten you to the point in your life where you're analytical and you can think about a lot of different types of businesses in different ways. Would you mind talking a little bit about your background?
Well, my background is all political. In fact, I came to Georgia to run the Republican Party in the 2002 cycle, where Republicans actually had a good year here. We elected Sonny Governor, elected Saxby to the Senate, and took control of the Georgia Senate. But I've been in politics for 16 years, and I still do. I still have about a third of my business is political. I'm like Michael Corleone. Just when I thought I was out, they keep pulling me back in. I keep promising my clients and my wife that I'm going to retire from this silly business, but I keep getting involved. But, you know, people say, well, you haven't been in marketing that long. I say, well, you're wrong. I've been in marketing for 16 years because what explained the difference to me between selling a candidate and selling a product or service? You have a candidate. You have to market that candidate. And how do you do that? Well, it's television commercials. It's direct mail. It's appearing on debates. It's doing those kinds of things versus marketing a product or service, which involves sometimes television commercials, direct mail, and other – there's hundreds of tactical tools you can use to market yourself. Then you got to make a sale. You have to convince a voter to vote for that person. You have to convince someone to buy a product or service. Mm-hmm. So, I've always been analytical in that because that's to me, the only thing that's really different is the product and how you market it.
That's interesting.
Is there a different strategy when you're marketing for a candidate as opposed to a business? Like a candidate, they have an election, and then that's it. It's over. Whereas a business, it's ongoing, so they have different it's a different objective.
You know, when you're selling a product or service, what you coach your clients to do is say, I have to help that prospect understand that there's a problem that my product or service can help them solve, or there's a need that I can help them fulfill. When you're talking about politics, let's use today's example. I have shifted the strategy and messaging on all my candidates' races right now to jobs in the economy because that's in our polling. That's all anybody wants to talk about. And I have some clients in Southern Nevada, for instance, and for the last 10 years, illegal immigration has been first and foremost the most important issue in Southern Nevada. It ranks about sixth right now. Unemployment in Southern Nevada is 8.6%. That's pretty high. And so what we're doing now is, in essence, we're trying to present a candidate who can help solve that problem. So, you know, my clients are all saying, I'm going to get in there and I want to figure out ways and I'm going to provide leadership and I'm going to try to help figure out how to improve our local economy and do the kind of things, get government off our backs. So it kind of depends on the circumstances and the issues, you know.
But you're relying on polling to tell you what the message should be?
Polling helps you, yes, it helps you determine what issues are on top of mind.
But can you trust the polling in today's day and age?
Polling is a little bit less reliable than it was even a few cycles ago because strictly of the increase in usage in cell phones. And that in most telephone surveys that you're seeing this day and age, cell phones are still not part of that. And there's a lot of people, particularly the younger generation, that don't have a home phone.
Right.
They all, they only, their device to reach people is in their mobile phone. So, but pulling, like virtually anything in life, there you can get what you pay for, and there's discount pulling that doesn't, that's not as reliable, but there are still very good ways. But pulling, I mean, you don't make 100% of your decision. It helps to guide you, and you may know without doing any pulling that, you know, in Atlanta, you know, jobs and economy is important, traffic's an issue, education is a concern. You don't need to spend money or time taking a poll to understand those things. But what a poll can also do is help you frame that messaging. Okay, mm-hmm. I know that education is important and on the minds of a lot of people. But how do I actually talk about it? You know, you mm-hmm. can test different solutions. You can test different ways to talk about it. You know, talk about the bailout. I think whoever concocted the name bailout when they were talking about this financial recovery package got in big trouble by calling it a bailout, because Main Street USA is thinking, I'm bailing out Wall Street.
Mm-hmm. It was probably the guy who did the death tax.
Well, that's another great example, a very common example that we use in this business about how not to, you know, how messaging can impact you. I mean, I just saw a survey that on this bailout package, it was about 31% of the people supported it and 55% were against it. Mm-hmm. Now, I guarantee you, if the question was asked, do you support the federal recovery program, or there's any other number of words that you could use to describe that package, that would probably, you would probably see dramatic difference in those numbers. But just calling it a bailout,
that's regarding polling as well. I mean, it's how you frame the question.
Absolutely.
Can give you the answer you want or not want.
So it sounds like there's things that keep you awake at night other than trying to come up with something else to call the bailout. I'm very curious to know about the writing of your Civil War novel and also about your political thriller screenplay. Can you tell us anything about
that? I have been a part of a lot of interesting political campaigns in my career. I've run governor's races in several states, from New Jersey to Nevada to Florida and Georgia, and I've worked with Jeb Bush on his campaign in 98. I was very central to President Bush's election in 2000, so I've been involved in a lot of different campaigns, and in those campaigns I've had some pretty interesting experiences. I'm not even talking about the Florida recount, which I could be a guest for another hour and talk about that whole interesting experience. But I just run across some interesting people, interesting experiences. And so over the course of all these years, I've always talked to people. I said, we need to write a story about these races. I think people would be intrigued by the internal workings of a campaign and what they don't see. And, you know, when you're watching reporting on a political race and you hear, well, there was dissension on the inside of the campaign, you darn right there's dissension. There's dissension and disagreement and argument on every campaign I've ever been a part of. It's just human nature. People just have a different idea of what the right messaging should be, what the right tactics should be, what the mail should look like. And so the campaigns are very vicious organisms. And so, which makes for some pretty interesting human theater. And so we're working on I'm working on a story. I'll probably get it done around 2020.
That's okay.
It's just something fun I'm working with. I'm a history major from Florida State. And being a history buff, I've always been fascinated by American history, and I think there's some great stories to tell. And so inspired by stories like Titanic or Apollo 13, obviously the space program, something that we know is big with me. But Civil War has been something in terms of studying history has been my most favorite topic. And so I spent a lot of time watching movies. And I said, you know what, it's about time I write my own. And so I'm writing this story about the Vicksburg campaign, which is in the Western Theater in the Civil War. It's overshadowed by, because it occurred roughly the same time as Gettysburg, and so that's obviously the better known tale from that era of the Civil War. But it's just a story about a small unit from Illinois that fought in that long campaign that culminated in the siege of Vicksburg.
So you'll have to keep us posted on that.
It's just how I keep my sanity after hours.
That and a little bit of tennis, huh?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for being our guest today. I hate to cut you short, but if people want to find out more about you, what's the best way for them to reach you? The
best way to find me is on my website, which is Intrepid, Intrepid-LLC.com. And they can also find me on my blog, which I have more fun doing, and I would recommend more because it's more interactive. But it's Intrepid Group, which is one word, www.blogspot.com.
Wonderful. Thanks so much for being with us and sharing today. Any final comments, Lee?
Great guests.
Yeah.
Real interesting, topical.
Very interesting. Until next week, we hope that you'll enjoy the rain and have a wonderful week.